KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I am very excited and really honored to have on two guests to discuss a topic that has gotten really scant attention, not just in the mainstream media, but even amongst in many disciplines where people you would think would be interested. The topic is fusion centers. And the guests are Professor Frank Pasquale at Seton Hall Law School and Professor Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law. Danielle and Frank are two leading scholars in their fields and particularly are really at the cutting edge of taking a close look at what are known as fusion centers. What are fusion centers? Well, fusion centers are set up generally by state and local governments, and they aim to create a system that collects, combines, assesses, and disseminates information related purportedly to terrorism, although perhaps it could be other hazards. This goal itself poses a lot of challenging questions and concerns affecting a broad range of areas, from privacy to intellectual property to criminal law enforcement to public-private partnerships, data mining, etc. And what these fusion centers are and what they are doing, to paraphrase Spinal Tap, is actually a very legitimate question regarding fusion centers. These are fairly recent developments, fairly recent law enforcement efforts, guided by the Department of Justice, but created at the state and local level. Now, of course, post-September 11th, there has been an increased and, of course, legitimate function or focus on averting terrorism. Indeed, this show is being recorded May 3rd, 2010, and this weekend, another potential terrorist plot was averted in New York City in Times Square. The purpose of fusion centers is apparently to go after those kinds of situations, to gather information in order to avert criminal activities, particularly terrorism, before they occur. The issues arise when we decide what fusion centers can do, what their provisions for operation are, what their priorities are, their purpose, their goals. And this is a new formalized form of law enforcement in the sense that these centers are designed to take information from the private sector and the public sector, fuse it, hence the name fusion centers, to come up with, again, information that purportedly would lead to fighting terrorism and averting terrorist acts. But because fusion centers are not well understood, because they are arguably not well defined, there are those in the IP community, in the privacy community, law enforcement, and otherwise that are concerned about how they operate and making sure that they operate within the bounds of law and good public policy. These topics will be broadly discussed with our two guests today, Professor Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law and Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall University School of Law. Both of these guests I am very excited to have on the show. Frank has been on the show previously discussing his cutting-edge work involving the regulation of search engines. I am thrilled to have Danielle on, someone whose work I've been a fan of as soon as I started reading it. So without further ado, Danielle, Frank, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm going to start off, and Danielle, I'll start with you, and I ask this question of all my guests, but I'll start with Danielle, and Frank, you can pick up as well. And it's a basic question. How did you become interested in fusion centers?
You know, Frank and I were just talking about that before we got on the phone with you. How did we get started on this project? And we attended the Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference, I want to say 2 years ago, and someone from EPIC was talking about fusion centers just when the ACLU had come out with a report called Fixing Fusion Centers, What's Wrong with Fusion Centers? And for both of us, we looked at each other, had never heard of them before, had no idea that how prominent it was for the law enforcement community it was. And we just had no idea the kind of privacy implications and problems with transparency and opacity in government decision making. And so we just looked at each other and thought, we've got to drill down here and start thinking about it. So I'm not sure if Frank has anything more to say, but we were together right, Frank, when we first learned about them?
We did, and, you know, we've been very impressed by the Computers, Freedom, and Privacy conferences over the years. I mean, I think it was the 38th annual conference that we were at, or it's been around for some time. There are a lot of real veterans of the privacy activism community there, but also a lot of representatives of corporations and government officials who are at these events. And when we did our presentation on fusion centers a few years later at one of these conferences with Priscilla Regan of George Mason, we got some interest also from people who were there representing people that were very involved in the whole process. They said this is a worthwhile thing that we need to have some more open public discussion about, at least the broad outlines of it. I also became interested in it because I just have found that I do a lot of work on Google, as you mentioned, Dave, and I really appreciated the chance to talk about it on a podcast on your show a couple of years ago. And what I found is that even when there is a critical mass of worry about Google or other information aggregators online, such as internet service providers, you know, Comcast, others, you always get a response where people say, well, you could always opt out. You could always go to another search engine, or you could try to do something else. Or, as the Google CEO Eric Schmidt once said, you know, if you are doing something online that you don't want anyone to know about, maybe you shouldn't be doing it, you know. And I think that that is a concern. And I think that what happens with the fusion centers is that you start to get people more realizing more that there's not really a fixed, hard and fast public-private divide online. That, in fact, a lot of the entities that we assume of as corporate private entities have connections to the government that, you know, we never really have conceptualized at the level of the interactions and the scope of the intensity of the transactions that are happening nowadays. So that's why I think it's an important thing to have on our agenda.
You know, the I'm sorry, Danielle, please.
No, such a terrific point in the sense of, you know, we think we're not going to get in trouble with the law if we don't commit a crime, or we're doing everything in our power, so law enforcement is going to stay far away from us. But what's interesting, Ms. Frank's insight, is that to the extent that we're writing online, we're in Web 2.0 websites, social networking, blogging, I mean, so much of our online presence is going to be looked at, used, thought about, mined for these fusion centers. And so that even in our private lives, the ways in which we're thinking we're interacting in very private-seeming capacities, that we don't think law enforcement is going to pay any attention to, that kind of information is going to be analyzed by law enforcement and at these fusion centers specifically.
You know, and I wanted to add on to that. I'm sorry, Dave.
No, please.
Is that, as Danielle is pointing out, I mean, just to give some concrete examples here, I think that it's very interesting to compare that, say, in the COINTELPRO concerns, when we were concerned about Edgar Hoover going after or looking at the surveilling 15,000 or so peace activists and other activists, you compare that to, say, the 400,000 people who are on certain lists, you know, that might be suspicious. And I think that one analog that people might think of to make it more comprehensible is to say, well, all of my commercial transactions and history are being fed into credit reports, and these are the sort of reputational score on people. And the concern that I think is valid here is what happens if these sort of reputational reporting systems, scoring systems, enter into many more aspects of life, like even the TSA no-fly list or other things like that, secretive algorithms that, you know, Danielle has done a lot of good work in her articles uncovering or writing about, and I know that's been a concern of yours, Dave. And so I think both of those are, imagine if you went from having a credit score to a security score. You know, should you know the score? Should the way the score is calculated be of some public concern? I think that's of great interest.
The real challenge here, and I think again, because in my view, fusion centers are still not really in the public eye. I certainly, in my own anecdata, when I've mentioned, working on this project, I've literally not met anyone, who said, oh yeah, I know about that. I'm always starting with what they are. And I've given a basic introduction, but I think in order to contextualize the discussion, I'll just ask you to expand on it. So, you know, when we say fusion centers, what do we mean? How do they operate? What do we see them doing? I mean, that's a longer discussion, but I suppose to contextualize, what would be your moderate answer to that question, Frank?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the key things about the fusion center is that we should begin an investigation and definition of it with an eye to what were the problems that led to their creation. And so, like, in a book like Shane Harris's book, The Watchers, you see a lot of law enforcement and intelligence agencies feeling very upset about missing, say, certain clues about what would lead to 9/11 and vowing that they would never allow silos between different government agencies to prevent that type of preventative or to deter that type of preventative awareness of potential threats, either to homeland security or to just ordinary criminal activity, could be part of the worries there. And so what it is ultimately about is information exchange, that you create sort of entities that allow for state and local officials to share information, for public and private officials to share information, different ways in which all of these entities that have awareness of what people are doing and where people may be going outside of their routine, that they can exchange this data and then mine the data in some cases to try to develop profiles of, say, suspicious activity.
The fusion centers themselves, Danielle, operate as physical spaces, do they not? I mean, where are they, and do we know how many there are?
Right. So I think at latest count there were 70 fusion centers, which means that, you know, of course, there are more than one in every state. So, for example, Maryland has two, and certain big cities have one for themselves, and then let's say Los Angeles and New York City have fusion centers of their own, and then there are fusion centers that are represent the state, and they are in various parts of the state, let's say in New York. So I think New York has two or three in total. And so, yes, they're physical entities, and what you see at a fusion center, it's not just, and you mentioned so well, Dave, I liked your definition. I thought when you said it, I thought, here, here, great job. You know, in two sentences, you've brought it together. But, you know, you explained that we have state and local authorities running them. That's true. But sitting alongside state and local law enforcement are also officials from either the Department of Homeland Security or DOJ or both. Typically, it's someone from DHS. And it may be that sitting physically alongside them are individuals from private entities. So, for example, the Washington Joint Analytics Center, it's the Washington State Fusion Center, has a representative from Boeing physically at the Fusion Center. And so what they're doing is, as Frank said, sharing information, but then also analyzing information through these virtual gateways, which taps into hundreds of databases from federal and state, private sector databases, dossiers that are amassed by data brokers, information on the net, putting it together, analyzing it, either driven by the suspicious activity report, which identifies someone and then says, hey, figure out if this person is indeed a threat, or by assessing patterns and coming up with potential targets, threats to critical infrastructure, and then also identifying people who may be suspected as threats. So both analyzing and then exchanging information.
Now,
I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, that definitely does, Frank.
And can I just add one other thing? I mean, you also could think of it as a reservoir of information that would to use to refer to a title of one of Danielle's pieces, Reservoirs of Danger, about sort of data collection and data leaks and breaches. One example that's given is that people that were trying to explain the multi-state anti-terrorism information exchange product asked a private firm called Sizent to be able to, say, instantly find the name and address of every brown-haired owner of a red Ford pickup truck in a 20-mile radius of a suspicious event. Okay. So you can see that that would be amazingly powerful information. I mean, just think of this thing that happened in New York with the Times Square being evacuated, you know, just being able to know immediately all of the possible owners or the people who were fit this description. This seems like it's incredible sort of data that would be quite helpful to lots of law enforcement investigations. But the worry here is that, and this is from Jack Balkin, you know, in the National Surveillance State, one of his leading articles on this, he said the worry is that basically the dangers of the government creates this parallel track of preventative law enforcement that's going to route around traditional guarantees of the Bill of Rights. And that finally, once governments have access to all of these powerful surveillance and data mining technologies, they've got that. You know, he's pointed that out. But the worry is that the political pressure becomes irresistible to push this further. So you're not just looking for terrorists after a while. Then you're looking for, say, insurance cheats. And I believe that's a purpose of one of the California centers. Is that right, Danny? I mean, I think that...
Yeah. Or they're at least establishing one, right, Frank? California Insurance Student Center.
Yeah, so we're going to push this beyond. And this is the other key phrase about these centers that I think people need to understand, is the all threats, all hazards model. So we're familiar with, you know, this distinction between war and law enforcement. And in war, there's very little oversight of, say, what the president, what the military is doing by necessity in many cases. I mean, war is existential threat. Whereas law enforcement, we have a very rich history of checks and balances and a delicate balance between the rights of the law enforcement and those who are being investigated. And the all threats, all hazards model is something that allows or potentially allows for an erosion of law enforcement in the name of saying that all of these things are really on a continuum and need to be investigated on that continuum.
We're talking with Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School and Professor Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law here on Hearsay Culture. Danielle, Frank, you know what? It seems to me when we think about these fusion centers that the issue really becomes how they're used and what the guidelines are. And I guess again, for listeners that aren't familiar, have there been any prosecutions of anyone anywhere in the United States as a result of data that has been collected and analyzed by fusion centers?
Yes, and I have, I think, two examples that are going to be really helpful to put this whole question in context. Okay, so the first is a fellow named Ken Crafty. He's a law student, night law student at University of Connecticut. And in his former life, before law school, he was a campaign manager for someone running on behalf of the Green Party, a candidate for in Congress. And he had previously been arrested at an anti-war rally, but not convicted, just arrested for, I think, disruptive behavior. And so as this was 2 years ago, governor gets elected in Connecticut, and she's holding a inaugural march or, you know, parade. Ken, sort of in advance of the parade, law enforcement had been handed out flyers that were generated and created by the Connecticut Fusion Center, a list of individuals who are considered threats by the Fusion Center, people to look out for law enforcement to arrest, presumably if they're seen at the parade. One of the individuals on the list was Ken Grafty, and included on that list issued by the Fusion Center was that he was formerly a member of the Green Party, he had run this person's campaign, he had been previously arrested in an anti-war rally, he had blogged about this parade and also the inaugural party that night and urged people to go and protest. And Ken was taking pictures at the parade, and just after he took a picture, he was arrested by police.
Wow.
He was in jail for 11 hours and then released. And afterwards, of course, officials reacted and said, we didn't even know we had a threat list. We disassociate ourselves from these kinds of activities. But, you know, that's many hours after Ken has been in jail. Of course, the prosecution went nowhere. It was immediately dropped by the prosecutor's office. But one can imagine how certainly disturbing it was that he was on a threat list, basically for political activities. So that's sort of one story, and that's from a year and a half ago.
The other one.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Dave. You want to follow up?
Oh no. I was going to say you had another example. I mean that's an interesting example we can talk about as well.
Yeah. So in Maryland, this was 2 years ago. Law enforcement, state police officers, had been overseeing or attending anti-war rallies and peace activist meetings, and then reporting back to the Fusion Center about individuals who were there at the meetings and what they were saying. What happened then was 53 individuals who were either part of an anti-war group or also a Greenpeace as well were listed as on a terrorist and drug list that was then shared, a federal database that was listed in a federal database as threats, 53 people who had attended these different rallies, including a nun, and an individual had run for Democratic Congress, were listed as threats in this federal database, but then was shared because, as Frank explained, it's a sharing environment, was then not only shared with federal agencies, but state and local ones as well, the fact that they were put on a threat list. And so it's then discovered Maryland ACLU, by chance, had put in a state open sunshine request because individuals felt like they had law enforcement attending meetings with them, and it was truly found by surprise. Through these responses to open sunshine requests. So those are two examples of where you had a nun and someone who had just run for Congress identified as a terrorist threat when all they were doing was going to meetings, either anti-war meetings or part of Greenpeace.
Now, these are two amazing stories, and Danielle, I'll ask you, Frank, as well. You know, both of these examples sound strange. It sounds like there's something that isn't working properly here, it seems. And I think to get to that is really a twofold question. And again, it gets to what these fusion centers are. First of all, in either of these situations, Danielle, did the law enforcement entities involved violate any rules of fusion centers? And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, what those rules are and where they come from. But then the larger question, really, the second part question, gets to, I think, what some of your concerns are. If there isn't a violation or were not violations of fusion center rules, then where are the problems? What do these examples illustrate beyond the obvious error in law enforcement decisions?
Right. So that's a terrific question. That is, what are the rules governing fusion centers? And then, of course, in these situations where they violated. So now, fusion centers have guidelines that were issued by Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security, and it's a very vague document. And it basically says that because states and local entities run them, that state and local law governs, sort of privacy law that comes from the state and local entities, govern these entities. And that to the extent that federal employees are sitting literally physically in the fusion center, their work, I'm not sure how one teases it out, but their work is governed by the Privacy Act. And so because fusion centers are given those federal funding, so, for example, $250 million this year alone was spent on sort of upgrading and then building new fusion centers in 2010, because federal money is given to fusion centers, they're governed by 28 CFR Part 23, which says that we can't collect or maintain information without reasonable suspicion that someone has committed a crime. Okay. So the question then, Dave, is, all right, so now that we know that to the extent that its state entity is working on matters that's governed by own state law, that if the feds are doing something, that they may in fact be governed by the Privacy Act, and that, of course, we've got this federal regulations that oversee this information. And I think there's a strong argument, at least in these two instances, that we have a violation of 28 CFR Part 23, that is there reasonable suspicion to believe that we're collecting information that a nun, you know, that these individuals in Maryland were committing a crime because they were meeting and talking about protesting the Iraq War. Same with Ken Krajewski, he's taking a picture, right, of the governor's inaugural parade. Does that amount to a reasonable suspicion they've committed a crime? And I would argue that probably not. Let's say no. some of the difficulty here, though, is in seeing that we have many different kinds of law that we're not sure what applies, and we have no oversight. In a sense, law sits in the seams. We're not sure what law applies, except for 28 CFR Part 23, and so it's so often that it's unclear what law applies, if at all, and we have no means to oversee it. And Frank, I bet you're going to want to jump in too on this point.
Frank? Well, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I think that was a terrific description of what's going on. And I think our big worry is, I mean, I want to put out there sort of the theoretical and legal worry, and then also the response that I think is just a minimum response. The worry is that you have essentially entities that we may not know exactly what they're doing with the data And so even if there are technically rules, like the part of the CFR that Danielle cited, even if those rules are out there, the worry is that how are we going to assure accountability? And one of the responses to that, that actually John Poindexter appeared to endorse in the Total Information Awareness Project that was, you know, floated in the early part of the 2000s, about 2003 or so, I believe, was to have an immutable audit log. And the idea there is that you would have a record of all the investigations that were started by the various fusion centers or other entities that rely on them, so that if we eventually thought that there might have been abuses, there would have at least be a record of the abuses. And so the solution there is less to have, and we can talk further about, you know, more direct responses, like the ACLU, I think, just wants to stop these things. But if we want to talk more about things that are immediately plausible, I think that given these already documented instances of problematic behavior, that we've got to think about having the immutable audit log, something that would be kept over time, sort of like David Brin's ideal of a transparent society, so that we would know exactly what's happening in a lot of these situations.
We're talking with Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall University School of Law, as well as Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law, on KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope you consider making a donation to KZSU and listening and continuing to listen to the station. So, you know, what you're talking about here, Frank, Danielle, is really, I think, and where we can transition to some of the, you know, issues and where we go from here, problems, boils down to, it seems, the basic challenge that we have on the internet generally, which is this clash between our, whatever our expectations of privacy are, and whatever we expect however we expect our data to be used, and arguably legitimate uses of that data, authorized or not. So you mentioned the idea that, you know, do we want or should we want something along the lines of a security score, along the lines of a credit score? Or do we expect that information that we put out there is going to be shared generally? Is the problem with fusion centers, and I want to get to the public-private partnership issues shortly, but from a top-level perspective, is the issue with fusion centers any different than the concern that we have when Facebook uses data or changes the terms of service without people's knowledge? I mean, putting aside the fact that someone could go to jail as a result, which is an obvious difference, from the perspective of what we do with data, are these fusion centers anything different than what we've seen from Facebook or from the content industry or from ISPs or anyone else?
Well, I think that one way to think about them, and I want to hear from Danielle's point of view on the sort of the use of social networks by the entities that are involved in the fusion centers, which I think is a really fascinating issue in itself. I think the larger trend here is that the public sector wants all the tools that the private sector has. And so to the extent that there is no difference, it might be a little bit worrisome, because the idea is that it's one thing to have a sort of panoptic sort of all of your behavior in order to determine if you should get an ad for orange juice or apple juice. It's another thing when that technology, which becomes incredibly advanced, and there's incredible amounts of data stored by, you know, ISPs, search engines, other entities, and then beyond that, fourth parties that are often used in order to get around rules that may govern information on third parties. When we look at all that information that's out there, even if we think that there are similar processes of aggregation and sifting going on, I think that the worry is that ultimately the stakes are much higher, And the other problem is that while it is in principle conceivable that you're going to, say, keep your web history on Google or be able to get a vision of what, say, your ISP, the information they have on you, I think that given national security exemptions to FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, it's much harder to envision that type of accountability, like we see in the EU Data Directive, for private entities ever coming to these entities, for the ordinary citizen.
Danielle?
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think what's really important to realize is that I think we've got to dispel people of the notion that the government sees information just as we do, with the most optimistic eyes, that, you know, we think something is really innocent. But when taken out of context, it can be misconstrued. And wrong, flat out wrong. I mean, if we were to be able to climb inside digital dossiers of, let's say, ChoicePoint, there is incorrect information, no doubt, included in someone's dossier. But what happens is you might lose a job if a dossier that's given to an employer, and that's bad, right? But if it's in the hands of government, you're included on a threat list, you may not only be have an increased chance of being investigated for a crime, you may have, you know, your question, you may have tax consequences, benefits consequences, you know, denied benefits as a result of something that seems like it contradicts information you've given government. So there's a whole panoply of different possibilities that when government has it, and I just want to underscore a point that Frank made so well, that when government has it, there are serious consequences, not only of imagine ones, you know, it has to do with life, but a whole lot of other ways besides just law enforcement. You could have immigration consequences based on information that's not true, and that you can't correct because you can't see it. And so that ties into our concern about opacity.
And I also wanted to add, layer to this is, I think that there is a worry that given the already vast size of the U.S. Penal, penitentiary, carceral infrastructure that has been documented by sociologists Louis LeQuant and Bernard Harcourt, who's a law professor at Chicago, has been looking a lot at what he calls neoliberal penality. The worry is that essentially you have a very large number of institutions that have a stake in designating as threats individuals. So, for example, you might say that, imagine sort of the computer security desk at a workplace, at a place of employment. If it never finds anyone doing anything wrong, then eventually there's going to be a question, well, why do we have these folks around if they never find anyone doing anything wrong? So there's a certain self-reinforcing dynamic that may be behind some of these entities and that may explain, you know, not necessarily the fusion centers, but that may explain sort of the already vast growth of the U.S. prison infrastructure, which is much faster than any other country in the world at the same level of income and development. And I think that those sorts of larger social concerns really should play into any larger expansion of, say, law enforcement or integration of law enforcement with military enforcement, because there's got to be a worry that, you know, there's going to be an undue expansion of the penal state in the wake of this, especially also when you look at a book like Paul Verquile's Outsourcing Sovereignty. The worry in a book like that is that you have entities that may be interested, there may be a close ties between, say, private contractors and entities like DHS or other types of government agencies, and that the profit potential there can lead perhaps to an undue amount of scrutiny or other issues going on. So I think these are all very difficult issues to look into, and I don't want to usurp the role of the legislature in trying to allocate funding for them. But I think that we should be keyed into a larger political economy critique of what's going on.
And, you know, that point, Frank, and what Danielle was saying earlier, I think, again, gets to, you know, some of the major issues here. I mean, given that this show is being recorded while the New York Police Department, the FBI, and countless other agencies are still combing through basic evidence to figure out what happened in Times Square this past weekend, you know, we can put aside, I think, unless you disagree with this, the idea that law enforcement certainly should have the ability to use available data and resources to prevent crimes. And so that issue aside, and of course the purpose of the show is not to assess concerns that the ACLU and others have mentioned involving profiling and whether that works or not. I think we can put that aside as beyond the scope of hearsay culture and certainly beyond the scope of my area of expertise or even comfort to talk about. But we can talk about this from the standpoint that assuming that there is some value in the operations of these fusion centers, we have entities that simultaneously, it seems, could theoretically help the New York Police Department identify someone who's going to blow up a van and also help a private insurer find an insured that isn't paying their premiums or is claiming that they're injured when they're not. And that gets to the issue, the broad issue of public-private partnerships that both of you have raised. It seems to me, and you know, by way of disclaimer for the listening audience, although anyone that listens to Hearsay Culture regularly knows this, I write in the area of trade secrecy and its impact on public transparency, and I have serious concerns when private entities are put in a position of assessing what's good for the public when it comes to knowledge and information. But here we're talking about ultimately decisions regarding enforcement of the law itself. And what law it is, or what law we're talking about, seems to be the primary concern. So my question boils down to this. How do private entities themselves do these assessments in the context of fusion centers? What incentives do they really have, not only to be involved with fusion centers, but to be making enforcement or law enforcement decisions?
Hey, Dave, before I think Fred should really answer that, so Frank, don't kill me for calling you out, can I just make one point?
Sure, please.
Before we go there, and I think it's a fabulous question, but just on the idea of, and I agree that we ought not dismantle them. I think they serve an important, can, the potential to serve a really important purpose. But, you know, the whole idea of connecting the dots is really what drives the increased funding of fusion centers. And what's interesting, though, is that there's incredible amount of work by computer scientists that say that data mining for terrorists is basically ineffective. You know, for example, we missed the Christmas bomber, right? That data mining for the purposes of finding a terrorist, now that may be not true for perhaps other kinds of crimes, but it's just we have so much data, but we're often drowning in it rather than getting better at it, finding individuals who are involved in terrorism. So I think it's just worth thinking about and realizing that there's a tremendous amount of research suggesting that data mining doesn't deliver on its promise of finding terrorists. Because terrorists are really smart, and as soon as we come up with a profile, they change their plans. And so I think it's worth realizing that we shouldn't be overly optimistic about what data mining can do, but yet we shouldn't abandon it as long as we certainly have a handle on human intelligence, because apparently 9/11 was not necessarily a problem of not connecting the dots. The information was there. It was a failure of human intelligence. So I think it's worth throwing that out there. So sorry, wonderful question about the public, the problems of law addressing, you know, the private sector individuals who are not only sitting at the fusion center, but also receiving information in the information sharing environment. And so the question is, how does law apply to them and why is this troubling? So Frank, I hate to re-ask Dave's question to you, and I'm happy to answer it too, right? But Frank, I don't know if you want to take that first.
Yeah, and actually, I'll say this before, since Daniel, since you took up the mantle, I'll merely say this. I recognize that the ACLU and others have challenged the ability to profile or data mine for terrorists. It seems to me, though, that's a separate question from whether we should have fusion centers in the first place. In other words, and again, this may be going too far afield on criminal law stuff, and I want to come back to the question for Frank to take up. But I guess to follow up on that point, is there a difference? In other words, when we talk about, this maybe is just a semantic point, but when we talk about what we mean by data mining or fusing data, is there any difference between what we colloquially understand as profiling versus that human intelligence, which might be based on knowing that someone traveled to this point or someone acted strange when a question was asked?
Right, and I think you know, when we think about human intelligence, it's often not based on some pattern that's built into an algorithm to find, not necessarily based on a profiling of, let's say, someone's race or religion or otherwise, but, you know, a set of characteristics that then we then search and mine through all this data to find and identify potential targets and then individuals. And it's folks like Jeff Jonas. I mean, this is not necessarily ACLU's making this argument, but computer scientists and the National Academy of Sciences have come out with studies that say this, it's not effective. We're going to have way too many false positives and also a waste of resources, which I think I'm all game for false positives if we find that, you know, needle in the haystack. But what's unfortunate comes at a great cost, which is waste of resources to spend on much more effective strategies in finding terrorists. So I'm not sure if that, I hope that answers the question, Dave, about, it's not really a policy argument that I'm making so much as it's a matter of computer science,
mm-hmm.
And whether it's indeed actually effective.
So it's an endeavor that's not worth the effort
it may not be,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It may be if you have a specific suspect or target in mind, but just general pattern kinds of data mining from particular number of studies have said it's not worth the trade-off of losing resources you can spend elsewhere.
Understood.
But that's just, I think, worth thinking about. It doesn't mean we ought not have them,
mm-hmm.
and we ought not do it,
mm-hmm.
but it's, I think, worth thinking about, especially as we think about the need for more oversight and audit logs and ways in which we can at least have some checks that laws brought into the picture. And part of the story is, as you say well, is, you know, what law would govern, let's say, a private party sitting at the table? And what's interesting, and Frank, I'm not going to steal your thunder, I promise. But, you know, when Frank and I presented this last summer at CFP, our project, we had two people come up to us from federal agencies and say, the one thing that terrifies us about fusion centers, in fact, is private sector individuals sitting at the table at fusion centers, because law, we can't govern what they do. We cannot control what happens when the information that we give them, you know, goes to their company. So I think that's really worth it. So, Frank, now all to you.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. It was a wonderful lead-up. And I just to give a little anecdote that I think really helps highlight some of the concerns there, this is from Paul Verkrail's book, Outsourcing Sovereignty, where he notes that, you know, a lot of officials in government are there for a short period, and there's a revolving door. And he notes that at the time he wrote the book, which was 2007, more than two-thirds of the Department of Homeland Security's most senior executives moved to private positions, some with companies who received lucrative contracts from the agency, end quote. And so the worry here, I think, is that you have, and this is a larger political worry in our system that, you know, drives a lot of concern these days, is a fusion of public and private in ways that reduce accountability. So, for example, if you look at Simon Johnson and Kwok's book, James Kwok's book, 13 Bankers, their concern is that there's a lack of transparency about the relationship between the Fed and the largest banks in the U.S., the sort of too big to fail problem. And if you look at critiques of the auto bailout, Charles Grassley just called GM's claim to have paid off its loan in the auto bailout as a TARP money shuffle, saying that effectively this sort of public-private fusion had obscured the real financial relationships there. And I think that what we're seeing is sort of some really interesting seismic shifts politically between people, among people who have put a lot of trust in these public-private partnerships, and those who say, well, these are great and they may be the only way that we can sort of work our way through times of enormous fiscal crisis and security threat. But that if we're going to do them, then we're going to have to impose on private entities the same types of due process rationales, the same types of openness requirements that we traditionally impose on the state. And so I think that is the big concern here, is that if you have private parties at the table who don't necessarily have to put all the cards down in the way that the state does or that state action operates, that's the worry. And there's going to be a lot of concern here. I think there may be a reinvigoration of, if not the non-delegation doctrine itself, or if not the state action doctrine itself, at least the traditional concerns that animated those types of common law, administrative law doctrines.
We're talking with Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School and Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law and Hearsay Culture. Danielle, Frank, we are, as amazing as it may sound, we only have about 6 minutes left, and I wanted to, at this point, at least ask you about the work you're doing in this area. I know that the two of you are working on a project together. Can you describe it, which perhaps gets to some of the solutions or suggestions you have for policymakers with regard to how to deal with fusion centers?
Yeah, so we're just at the stage of starting to sit down and write a piece about ways in which we can think through the both legal and policy problems of these fusion centers and make suggestions and recommendations so that we can both use them and effectively use them without raising significant concerns. So we're thinking through the ways in which we have, you know, figuring out what law applies and law sort of sits in the seams and what do we do about it. And we have transparency problems. And thinking through how can we set up these systems so that they both adhere to the rule of law, but yet also, of course, are effective tools for law enforcement and anti-terrorism efforts more generally.
Yes, that's a very eloquent description of some of the directions we're going for. We're also, I think, one of the key things that we're trying to illuminate here is the idea that the state has had a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. You know, that's sort of the definition of the state in Weberian terms. And we want to explore what does it mean when we start putting private entities into that power structure. And we also are just thinking about it in terms of new ways of ensuring accountability. When we have so much going on, so much power being delegated from the state to private entities, how do we ensure accountability? And I think there's some interesting concerns here, again, across the board, where we're trying to work, we're trying to use the fusion centers as a case study for a larger theory of accountability of, say, private and public entities that are working together in the 21st century.
This topic of fusion centers, I guess, is as a somewhat closing question, brings to mind, a lot of the work that or discussion that we've seen, especially pop up post 9/11 with respect to entities like Blackwater, but also going back generally to other public-private partnerships that have eluded any kind of public debate and discussion. And it seems, and this is kind of the crystal ball question that I usually ask and ask in an unfair way by limiting the time that you have to answer it, but it does seem to me, and this is a trend that I've noticed, that there's an increased blurring between the role of the public and private sector when it comes to issues involving these core decisions of how law enforcement decisions are made. And in the case of the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which is getting a lot of attention finally, we're also seeing less transparency in terms of how law is created. Are fusion centers, in your view, part of this, part of a general trend that we see where we have power grabs coming not just from the government, which is what we're used to in the context of law enforcement, but from the private sector itself?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that essentially one of the main concerns here, and one thing that we want to get much more discussion of, is are there ways in which certain private entities can coax and commandeer data from the government in ways that are mainly for commercial purposes, say for marketing purposes, for law, for enforcement of judgments, for going after people, or for finding out who might be good risk or bad risk. All of those things we think are very important that we keep very close tabs on that. And I think that one of the other topics as well is, given the complexity of contemporary life, and I think your ACTA example is an excellent example, a lot of times the government has to rely on people in the private sector just for an account of what's happening in their sector. And especially if you consider that you might have some people in the SEC who are making 10 to 100 times less than the people that they're regulating. Those people that they're regulating can spend enormous amounts of money on attorneys, lobbyists, others, promises of lucrative employment that can really make the determinants of winners and losers in today's economy who may well have the closest relationship to the government. And I think that that's one larger concern here that, you know, we think is a larger issue that needs to be part of the agenda.
And I think just at the beginning of lots of really thorny issues about privacy and civil liberties as we have this sort of enmeshing of the public and private sector because things, as Frank says, are so complex.
The topic was fusion centers. The guest, Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall Law School and Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland. Danielle, Frank, for those people that want to learn more about fusion centers themselves, I mean, this in and of itself is a tricky question because there isn't a ton out there. But do you have any suggestions of resources that people could go to learn more about what these are?
Yeah, you know, the ACLU's website has really the most detailed, I think, information about fusion centers. So EPICS, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, is also very helpful. But ACLU, you know, Jay Stanley and Mike German have been kind of at the forefront of this issue and have two reports on fusion centers. And that's on a map of where are these fusion centers, you know, how many we have. And so I think if you're interested, I'd go to the ACLU's website.
Danielle Citron. Oh, I'm sorry, Frank, do you have something to add there?
Sorry, just to add to that, I mean, I think in terms of the lawyer, law professor of literature, John D. Michael's article, All the President's Spies, and Jack Balkin's The National Surveillance State, are both excellent.
This is a topic that obviously is only tip of the iceberg, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I am a fan of both of your works, and Danielle's work on due process on the internet and technology is cutting edge, and we use that phrase loosely, but it really is. And Frank and I share a general what some view radical view of how government should be behaving and private sector should be behaving in the context of sharing information. So we are allies there. Regardless, the purpose of the show is to bring topics to the public sphere that are not getting as much attention, and to cover the bases in a fair and accurate way. And I certainly think with Danielle and Frank, I look forward to seeing your piece, and I know it's going to be both thorough and balanced. And I thank you again for taking the time to be on the show and for educating my listeners. And I invite you back because fusion centers are definitely not going away, at least from what I can tell, and I look forward to having you back on the show, perhaps when your article's out, to talk about these topics in more detail.
That's great, and thank you for having such a terrific show, Dave.
Well, thank you, Danielle.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's fantastic. It's really great to be on with you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to have on, coming up the rest of the quarter, several other exciting guests doing really interesting work. Coming up next week, Professor Shubha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin Law School will be on discussing a mutual interest of ours in open government laws generally. And then continuing in this line, and I try to put guests together in this way, continuing this line of discussion of technology and government, Laura DeNardis, the Executive Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, will be on discussing her book, Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance. Dr. Grant McCracken will be on of MIT discussing his book, Chief Culture Officer. Entering June, Professor Ken Wark of the Eugene Lang College at the New School will be on discussing his work, and he's been doing work on hackers, which is perhaps a pejorative term, but perhaps computer engineers more broadly, security engineers even more broadly. We'll be on discussing his work. And to close the quarter, Greg Nogheim, Senior Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, will be on also discussing his view of fusion centers and other projects that CDT is involved with. Future guests include Professor Siva Vaidyanathan for the University of Virginia, author of the forthcoming book, The Googleization of Everything, Professor Rebecca Eisenberg of the University of Michigan Law School, and Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh Law School, another scholar whose work I am a huge fan of, and we share mutual interests involving broadly the sharing of information. I am always looking for interesting guests and suggestions, people that should be on the show, so I encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show the best way, live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can also pick up the show by podcast by going any number of ways to hearsayculture.com. freemanculture.com, where you can get all previous shows and shows coming up. You can also get the show through the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page by typing Stanford Center for Internet Society into the iTunes search engine. And lastly, by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thanks again for listening to the show today. I hope you found it educational and enjoyable. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.